still in their nightclothes, Natalia and Annie and Maria huddled around the primary radio. Natalia looked up and saw Sarah returning from the storage area where the auxiliary radio was kept.
He's speaking in German. It's clearer now, but the signal is so terribly weak. Before, I wasn't even sure of the language.
Natalia looked at Maria Leuden.
You agree?
Natalia handed Maria the headset and she put it on.
Yes. Yes, German, definitely. Perhaps a downed pilot.
Maria gave the headset back to Natalia.
Well, that makes sense. What do we do about it? I tried getting out on the second radio and there wasn't any luck. I can't tell if it's Soviet jamming or weather conditions or what. I checked the antenna lead all the way until it disappeared into the access shaft.
Natalia worked the dials on the radio again. Her head started to ache from straining to hear through the headset.
If the man on the other end of this transmission is a downed pilot, he's in trouble, or certainly seems to be. With the cold outside, that could mean he's in danger of dying. On one hand, we should go out and attempt to find him. That shouldn't be that hard. I can adjust a walkie-talkie to the proper frequency, and as the signal strength increases, we'll eventually find him. If he's getting through and we're unable to get out, he must be very close, despite the weak signal. He could be low on power. On the other hand, this could be some sort of ruse to get us out of the retreat. It could be Rausch out there waiting for us.
We cannot leave the man.
I know that. This is your house, Sarah. What do you suggest?
Two go out and two stay. Annie and Maria can...
No, damn it! Look, you are not wandering around climbing rocks in sub-zero temperatures with the baby. Natalia and I should go.
She's right.
Natalia removed the headset, stood up, and smoothed her hair.
She is.
Sarah touched at her abdomen.
You're right. But I don't have to like it. You'll need a code phrase in case there's something wrong.
Yes.
Natalia thought of the black jumpsuit hanging in the closet. If it belonged to some other Natalia, she hoped it fit anyway.
Whatever you have to say, you can say it to the three of us.
Vasily Prokopyev's eyes looked slightly glassy, but he sounded normal enough. Rourke had looked at his chart and supposed the glassiness was a result of medication. 5 centuries ago, Vasily Prokopyev would have died, or in the best-case scenario, have lost several limbs. But treatment of frostbite and exposure-related injuries advanced considerably. The prognosis on the chart was a good one for restoration to normal health. Prokopyev nodded. His speech was a little slurred, but seemed otherwise lucid as he spoke.
I was called before the comrade marshal.
Antonovich?
He spoke to me of his desire to end war with war. But how then he realized his desire could not be fulfilled as he originally hoped. That instead, there would be the destruction of mankind.
What the...
Let him finish, Michael.
Prokopyev nodded again.
Particle beam technology. The comrade marshal told me that it is so advanced now that the particle beam weapons can be mounted in helicopter gunships, on tanks, made in whatever size or power range is needed, even as machine guns for the infantry.
Rourke shivered. In his mind, he saw Reed as the Army intelligence officer climbed the masts for the particle beam weapons at the Soviet womb in Colorado. He recalled how, with his dying breath, Reed tried to raise the American flag in a symbol of defiance.
The comrade marshal told me that no power on Earth would be able to stand against these particle beam devices, except by use of nuclear weapons. In New Germany, nuclear weapons are under development. There is still the Chinese nuclear arsenal somewhere out there, and the Soviet community beneath the sea has such weapons as well. Once the new particle beam weapons are used in the field, nuclear weapons will be used against them. And this will bring the end of mankind. The comrade marshal gave me a small canister, so small that it is little larger than a spool of thread. There is film inside that canister of the plans for the particle beam devices. I am to give this film to you. He told me that he trusted you will do the right thing with it. In addition, I am to tell Major Chemerovna a message. The Comrade Marshall says she was right about him after all. That he was not born to Karamazov's work. Finally, I am to tell you, Dr. Rourke, that he believes that this changes nothing between you two. He would kill you if he had the chance. And I quote him, I would expect the same courtesy from him.
John Rourke leaned heavily against the hard plastic footboard of the bed.
You don't have this capsule anymore, do you?
It is in the half-track truck. It was safer there. The child, you understand.
Yes. You must tell us, Vasily, where we can find this truck. We must find the capsule, and I must get its contents to Allied scientists. And I hope we can somehow find a defense, even if it means crafting these weapons ourselves.
Prokopyev looked tired and weak.
I will need a map, Doctor.
Annie Rourke Rubinstein always felt awkwardly unfeminine wearing trousers or pants of any kind and avoided them with a passion, but logic dictated the heavy Arctic weight snow pants because of the severe cold. Annie learned to listen to her own logic, so she wore them. John Rourke spent 5 years with them, training them in survival and in the ability to educate themselves. Still, the training didn't cover everything. As Annie matured, she felt a need to assert her femininity within the larger framework of personality development. There were no girlfriends with whom to share secrets and experiences, no older women to whom she could go for advice. She had to construct her own role through trial and error, find a linchpin for her concept of self. She remembered one of her father's lessons.
No matter how much you know, you will never fully know yourself. No matter how much you learn, if you ever consider your education completed, you'll have learned nothing. The work of learning to know yourself is the ultimate discipline.
To abide by this advice, she had to maintain her own identity, separate from that of her brother. And as a constant reminder of her gender, there were the cryogenically sleeping role models of her mother, Sarah, and Natalia, tantalizingly near, yet unable to be confided in, questioned, or imitated. Annie and Michael spent their nights alone in the retreat in various pursuits, books, music, videos, chess, physical fitness, but there were other needs to make, to do. Michael would work with guns and radios and machinery, although Annie could detail strip a .45 automatic or a Colt assault rifle as quickly and well as he, and knew basic maintenance for the equipment housed at the retreat. She taught herself other things to pass the time: dressmaking, knitting, crocheting, and design. The clothes she made were not only for herself but for her brother, a shirt, a sweater. Her father planned ahead, laying in the supplies she would need to make clothing and for crafts. Sometimes when she thought about it, she smiled, imagining her plus-6-foot father, his twin Detonics 45s under his battered old leather bomber jacket, going into a fabric store and purchasing material, yarn, thread, embroidery floss, even the sewing machine housed at the retreat, along with, of course, a spare parts kit and detailed maintenance manuals. They would work their garden plots in the precious few months that passed for a growing season during those years, but in the winter months, with time in the out-of-doors cut back, her work became all that much more consuming and symbolic of her own identity. Now, as she and Natalia stepped into the frigid blasts just beyond the retreat's exterior door, Annie drew the scarf layered over the toque that already covered her face still tighter. She was glad she heeded that little voice of logic again. It had been hard waiting, doing the necessary things while the voice of the injured man droned on over the radio, begging for help for his internal injuries, his dizziness, the cold. But if Annie and Natalia were to have any hope of reaching him and any hope of getting back to the retreat, not to mention guarding against the possibility of a trap, they had to spend time in preparation. While Sarah and Natalia worked to change two of the walkie-talkies to the appropriate frequency for the downed pilot's broadcast, Annie quickly field-stripped and cleaned the firearms they would take with them, ensuring that the lubrication was sparingly applied. Any gummy residues that could turn to sludge in such cold were scrubbed away with added care beyond the usual. Maria packed small rucksacks for them that contained emergency medical supplies, lightweight insulating blankets, even some food, just in case. As the main entrance to the retreat closed behind them, despite Natalia's presence, Annie had never felt more isolated because the darkness was so unremitting, the swirl of snow around them like a giant dust devil or tornado, the wind so strong she could barely stand against it. She felt as if the very elements surrounded her, shielded her from contact with any fellow human being. She tried to force the thoughts from her head, telling herself that she should concentrate on the mission, finding and saving this downed German pilot who made such plaintive appeals over the radio for assistance. But when she thought of the mission, the sense of isolation mingled with foreboding. Snow beat malevolently against the vision-corrected armored glass, sparring with the vehicle's windshield wipers. Where the snow stayed out of reach of wiper blades and the convection heating system wired into the glass, the magnified crystal shapes were touchingly beautiful. Their prototype vehicle was rushed into the service of the German war machine with the title Armored All-Terrain Severe Atmospheric Conditions Vehicle. With the German penchant for complex naming, a helicopter could be called a machine which screws itself into the air. John Rourke thought the ungainly name might stick, so Rourke merely labeled it with the equally awkward acronym the first letters of the English translation made, AATSACV. He pronounced it ATSAC. The ATSAC, equipped with side sensors and heads-up display in the windshield for enhanced navigation with the blast shield closed, piloted well. He watched over Michael's shoulder as Michael drove the ATSAC. Because of the truly gigantic tires, 3 meters high, and independent suspension, the ATSAC actually moved faster and smoother than Rourke expected for something so big. It was roughly twice the size of the motorhomes made by firms like Winnebago before the night of the war. No color television or entertainment system, he reflected, smiling. But there was the modern incarnation of a microwave oven for heating rations. The oven buzzed, and Rourke moved along the ATSAC's deck. Despite the rugged terrain, the self-compensating computer-controlled suspension gave him an environment steady and level enough to perform delicate surgery. With the heat turned to a comfortable level, John, Paul, and Michael could move about in shirt sleeves. Rourke took the hot soup from the microwave, set it on the counter, and ate as he thought. He often thought more clearly while thinking of several things at once, so while he ate, he scanned the pages of one of the technical manuals for the ATSAC. The difficulty of the technical German text, in a curious way, almost heightened his abilities to focus a portion of his concentration in other directions, namely the particle beam technology. Antonovich's remarks to Vasily Prokopyev, however apocalyptic, might well prove to be a conservative estimate of the emerging situation. If the land-based Soviets could, through use of this superior technology, make their armies into an all but invincible juggernaut, and if this were backed up by the sea power of the historic enemies of Midwake, with their submarine-based thermonuclear missiles as the trump card, the Germans would have no choice but to use their nuclear arsenal. But as few as 1 or 2 nuclear detonations above ground could destroy the already fragile atmosphere of the planet, ensuring the end of life on the surface forever, and the end of mankind. All hopes, all dreams, everything. John put down the soup spoon. Natalia Anastasia Temerovna turned her face away from the wind. She adjusted both the black silk scarves over her face and head and the silk toque beneath them, repositioned her snow goggles as well, then pulled the snorkel hood more tightly closed at the front of her face. It created tunnel vision, but there was no choice. As she walked, bent against the wind, Annie beside her, she dug in the climbing staff she carried. After only 5 minutes, the visibility so terrible, the wind so strong, they decided their only safe course of action was to tie themselves together. The clothing they wore was such that they could be exposed to the temperature extreme around them for quite some time without feeling ill effects, at least theoretically. She was beginning to doubt the theory. The fronts of her thighs, her forehead, her feet and hands were all starting to feel stiff with the cold and wind. As they walked, she made a decision. If they couldn't find the downed pilot in the next 10 minutes, they would turn back. It would be that or lose their lives. She had not yet mentioned her decision to Annie. There was no opportunity to speak, with the wind shrieking through each crevice and niche of rocks, through the snow-buried boughs of the pines. To speak and be heard, it would be necessary to push back her parka hood and remove at least one facial covering and almost touch one's mouth to the other person's ear and then shout. Natalia kept moving instead. The road leading up and down from the retreat's main entrance was what they followed since leaving. Logic dictated that if the downed airman's craft landed too far away from the road, they would not hear him at all because no craft could have survived the crash. But there were flatter, more level spaces to the side of the road nearer to the base of the mountain, the places where 5 centuries ago the Soviet aircraft under the command of Rozhdestvenskaya landed KGB elite corps troops in an effort to locate and destroy the retreat before the fires swept the sky. It was here, in once wooded meadows, now feet deep with snow, that the downed pilot would have attempted to land. They crossed up into a small, more level expanse of the road, where the snow lay less deep. The walking grew easier by comparison, but the wind grew stronger, and Natalia instantly felt colder. Even so, she smiled. It felt good to be in action again, although she doubted Dr. Rothstein at Midway would agree. She looked to her pistol belt, the snow that had accumulated on the flaps of her holsters nearly blown away by the stronger wind. As the road began to angle down again, she felt Annie tug at the rope. Natalia looked toward her, saw her gesturing out beyond the road, and Natalia's eyes followed the direction Annie pointed. 200 yards away, in one of the flat expanses, they saw a German gunship, all but burned beyond recognition, merely a skeleton remaining. Natalia nodded, shifting her M16 forward, hoping it would still work as they started down from the road toward the wreck. Michael Rourke saw the truck, a Soviet half-track, almost wholly buried in snow, wedged against jagged outcroppings of almost black-looking granite. The rocks themselves saved the truck from being totally obscured by the snow. He shifted his shoulder beneath his parka under the weight of the double shoulder holster for his Berettas. Through his snow goggles, he scanned the ground in an attempt to find passage at once safe and convenient between his present location above the truck and the truck itself. He could always double back. He certainly was not willing to risk a broken leg or worse simply to save a few minutes in reaching the truck.
Maybe.
He saw a sort of path, drifted over high with snow, so its actual outline and depth were in doubt. If he were cautious, it would be worth a try, with minimal risk. Michael opened the Velcro closure of one of his parka's side pockets and pulled out a small short-range German handset.
This is Hunter 3 calling Hunter 1 and Hunter 2. Are you reading me? This is Hunter 3 calling Hunter 1 and Hunter 2. Do you read? Over.
This is Hunter 1 reading you loud and clear. I've just rendezvoused with Hunter 2. Over.
Hunter 1, I have found the quarry. I say again, have found the quarry. Do you roger that? Over.
Hunter 3, I roger that. Good work. Leave your transmission open and we will close with your position. Do you roger that? Over.
I roger that, Hunter 1. Wilco, Hunter 3 out.
Michael slipped the radio handset back into the parka pocket and closed the flap, but the radio was still set to broadcast, and its signal could be used by his father, Hunter 1, and his brother-in-law, Hunter 2, to home in on him. He shifted the M16, positioning it diagonally across his back, left shoulder to right hip on its sling now. Both hands might be needed, and there was no sign, for as far as he could see, of human life. The 4-inch-barreled Model 629 was holstered excessively enough at his waist in a flap holster, and the knife old Jan the Swordmaker gave him rode at his hip, even more accessible than the revolver. Michael started picking his way through the drifts, along what he hoped was a navigable path. Working his way along, he recalled the story his father told him concerning the origins of the heroically proportioned Life Support System 10. His father and the Weatherford, Texas knife maker Jack Grain were friends. Not long before the night of the war, they discussed a knife of the same basic design as the Life Support System 1, but larger. The idea was not just to use a longer blade, but to design it proportionately larger so the knife wouldn't just be bigger, but of superior strength and mass and serviceability. Originally, John planned to carry this knife himself, but his father's will, John told him, he instead put it away for Michael to use someday. Unwittingly, when old Jan the Swordmaker gave Michael the Life Support System 1, it freed John of the unspoken promise to his son. Because of the ferocity of close combat, at times John often considered using the knife, but had never done so. With Michael carrying his own, slightly smaller, 3 inches shorter in the blade and reduced overall dimensions, though essentially equal knife, John decided to use the System 10 himself.
Well now, Michael, someday it can be for your son.
Michael halved the distance between the rocky outcropping from which he'd first seen the Soviet half-track truck and the truck itself. The snow was deeper than he hoped, and the going slower. The drifts stood well above his waist. The only means of locomotion at all practical for Michael Rourke was to work his way along the rocks flanking the path, virtually hand over hand, raising his legs as high as he could, lurching ahead and downward. He slipped, falling full into the snow, half burying himself with it, swimming out of it and to his feet. He brushed the snow away from his goggles and as much as he could from the flap holster and his knife. Michael started along the path again, a 2-foot square patch of the truck's cab and a 6-foot or so square patch of the vehicle's left side, all that guided him. There was a bend in the path, and despite his exhaustion from the struggle of merely trying to walk and his eagerness to reach the truck, he stopped, assessing what might possibly lie around the bend. There were still no signs of footprints or vehicle treads anywhere visible around the area, but with the velocity of the wind and the volume of the snowfall, such traces would obliterate almost instantly. Michael swung the M16 forward, brushing snow from the closed dust cover from the trigger guard. He didn't remove the rubberized muzzle plug, since he could shoot through it if that was necessary, and accumulating snow down the bore would pose a worse threat of obstruction. His gloved fist on the Colt assault rifle's pistol grip, his right thumb poised at the selector, Michael moved forward. As he reached the spot where the rugged track he followed took an almost unnaturally sharp right angle, he leaned forward, the muzzle of the M16 out ahead of him. Michael's wrist almost snapped as whatever it was, a blur of grayish-white against the snow and the darkness, hit the M16 at the carrying handle. The pistol grip slipped from his momentarily numbed fingers. Hands gloved in discolored brownish-pink leather tore at the rifle, but the rifle was still slung to Michael cross-body, and he was dragged forward. As he fell, he reached for the revolver, but the fingers on his right hand still couldn't close. He threw his left hand out ahead of him. His fingers splayed, palm flat, as he plowed into and through the snow. Something ripped at the sling, twisting it. The sling bit deep into the left side of Michael's neck. Michael tried pulling away, got to his left knee. The hands grabbing the gun were half-gloved, half-wrapped in human skin, and the face was nearly obscured in a frozen mat of beard, eyebrows, and long hair that almost hooded the head. Eyes glowed out at him from the center. As Michael twisted at the sling, something hit his right arm, and he fell left. He realized as he fell that not his arm had been struck, but the rifle stock. A club, no, a human femur, swung through the air toward him. Michael's left hand found the butt of his knife. He swung it, slicing through the sling. He dropped away from the M16 as the femur passed inches from his eyes and nose. He slipped back through the snow, down along the rocky defile that had been his path to the Soviet half-track truck, spreading his arms and legs to slow himself. Feeling returned to his right wrist and hand, and with it, pain. A second wild tribesman threw himself forward, diving, landing in the snow inches from Michael as Michael skidded into a wall of granite. His left shoulder hit it hard. He nearly lost the knife. Michael rolled, freed the 629 from his holster, aimed and squeezed. The second wild man flopped to the snow, but the first continued headlong at Michael. The wild tribesman slammed into the cab of the Soviet half-track truck below. Michael lay there for an instant, catching his breath. Sweat bathed his body beneath the Arctic gear. He was suddenly freezing cold. His right arm was still vaguely numb. Then it was time to move. Michael staggered to his feet, stumbled, caught himself. There were things to do. Check the body still on the path. His father and Paul would be coming, might have heard the sounds of the fight over the open radio transmitter in his right outside pocket, unless it was smashed. But they would have heard the sound of the gunfire at any event, and so would any Russian patrols in the area. Michael moved toward the edge of the path, took a quick glance at the motionless body still on the trail, and then looked down. He could see the legs of the wild tribe cannibal twisted, protruding up through the cab of the half-track truck. He looked up the path, spotted his M16 in the snow, and moved toward it. Michael reached the rifle. He put the 629 back in its holster and picked up the M16. He parked it under his limp right arm and swept the snow from the bolt as he turned to head down the path. He knew only too well that if he didn't keep moving until the sweat dried gradually from body heat, he stood a chance of freezing to death. The man from the charred helicopter was little more than a boy, a lieutenant in Wolfgang Mann's command, judging by the uniform insignia he wore. But the head wound was so severe, Annie marveled that he was able to function.
I can't believe he was able to send the transmission at all, Natalia.
Natalia knelt beside her in the meager shelter of the gunship as they fought to stabilize his condition to the point where it might be possible to get him back to the facilities at the retreat, and there, just perhaps, save his life.
He didn't make the transmissions. I'd be willing to bet on that.
Natalia kept her voice so low that Annie could barely hear her over the keening of the wind.
This is a trap. He is real, all right, and the injuries certainly are. But there's something wrong, Annie.
Annie looked around them. There were no signs of booby traps in the wrecked gunship, but that could have meant that there really were some. There were no footprints outside the machine, but with the wind blowing and the drifting of the snow, any such markings would have been erased within seconds of being made.
Are you sure? I've seen enough head injuries in my life to know these men couldn't have been talking on the radio. This head wound would have made him unconscious, like he is now, instantly. Someone else sent a transmission and left this poor man here for us to find so everything would look genuine.
To get us out here? But why not
strike now?
Natalia looked up from her work.
Whoever it is wants all of us. That means getting inside the retreat.
We can't not take him back. He'd die. What'll we do, Natalia?
I'm working on that.
Annie could see her eyes smiling where the snow goggles were pulled down. Annie drew her M16 closer to her before continuing to dress the shrapnel wound in the man's left shoulder. John Rourke stood beside Michael as Paul walked back to them from the Soviet half-track truck. The location Vasily Prokopyev gave for the capsule containing the data on the particle beam technology was quite specific. Paul opened his right hand and John Rourke opened his. The capsule dropped from one gloved hand to the other.
How do we read this?
John glanced at his son. Michael was rubbing his right arm near the wrist. After as thorough an examination as circumstances allowed under such severe weather conditions, John Rourke was quite confident there was no serious damage.
I think it's some sort of microfilm or microdot. In either case, we should be able to find a means of reading it aboard the ADSAC, which is the next order of business, gentlemen.
Rourke looked at his son and at his friend. John slung his M16 slightly forward as he secured the capsule carefully into an inner pocket of his parka.
If anything happens on the way, this has to get through to New Germany and to Midway.
Why both? For the obvious reason?
John smiled and nodded.
If they both have it, neither one will have the edge. I don't want to have one war lead us into another. Come on!
John pulled up the snow goggles as he tightened the snorkel hood closer about his face. There seemed to be two classes of these J-7V aircraft, Jason Darkwood noted, and this was evidently one from the luxury class. Colonel Mann's J-7V had a full bathroom, everything included, even a small shower, much like those on Soviet scout-class submarines. The pain in Darkwood's head and neck throbbed only moderately. He took the container of pills given him by Dr. Munchen and opened it. He was to take one every 4 hours and have the prescription renewed at New Germany. And yes, Dr. Munchen told him, the drug they contained reacted with adrenaline, in some patients more than others, but the reaction was not harmful. Jason also realized there were two definitions of the word harmful. To him, as a fleet officer in the United States Navy, a little pain was better than a lot of impaired judgment and a nervous reaction that prevented normal activity. He spilled the contents of the bottle into the chemical toilet and flushed it. He looked at himself in the mirror, noticed he was smiling. Captain Darkwood felt better already. Otto Hammerschmidt realized he was on the horns of the proverbial dilemma. He was a captain. He was playing chess with the ranking field grade commander in all of New Germany, Colonel Wolfgang Mann. There were general staff personnel, of course, but they never ventured into the field. The dilemma was that he could checkmate Colonel Mann on the next move.
And what are you waiting for, Captain?
Hammerschmidt looked up.
Colonel?
Do you have so little respect for me, Hammerschmidt?
I have the greatest respect for you, Colonel. You are the finest officer under whom I have ever served or could hope to serve.
Well, then...
Hammerschmidt shrugged his shoulders.
Checkmate, Colonel.
He moved the White Queen. Horst Hammerschmidt remembered the time he and his older brother Otto ran afoul of three boys in the youth. The boys, schoolmates of Otto's, pressed after Otto for several months to join the youth and abandon his school athletics. It was because Otto was so good in intramural sports that it was not compulsory for him to join the youth. Horst Hammerschmidt perfected his athletic abilities so he could achieve the same exemption. In those days, there was no question, at least among the younger people of New Germany, of the leader's near infallibility and the preeminence of Nazism over all other philosophies, had any others even been openly available for study. But many of the youth were fanatics. The three boys followed Otto and Horst home from a track competition in which older and younger boys were competing. Horst competed in the triple broad jump, the 220, and the 440, not against his brother, but against students his own age and year. Otto was master of the 220, but excelled equally at the mile and the high jump. On the way toward the main entrance to the city from the playing field, the three boys from the youth intercepted them. Their leader, Hugo Gerdler, an older boy who, it was said, worked with the youth simply to satisfy his unnatural sexual appetites, insisted then and there that Otto and Horst quit athletics and join the youth. Otto's word was law with Horst then, the beginnings of the enduring respect he held for his older brother. Otto looked at him, then Otto looked at Hugo Gerdler.
I will not, Hugo, nor will my brother Horst. Now leave us.
Take them. Show them what happens when they don't obey.
Hugo Gerdler stepped back, and the two youth boys showed the heavy wooden clubs they carried. With a quick flurry of punches, the Hammerschmidt brothers dropped the two attackers and took their clubs. Then Otto turned to Hugo Gerdler, who stood, paralyzed with fear as his cronies ran off.
Hugo!
Run, Hugo! Run!
Fight me, Hugo!
I will not fight you!
Otto stepped up to Hugo. Otto's fast uppercut knocked Hugo Gerdler on his rear. Otto hauled Hugo to his feet.
Please! Please! Don't hit me anymore, please!
If you ever bother me or my brother again, I will beat you until you have no tears left. Remember that.
Otto let go of Hugo's uniform front and let Gerdler fall back into the grass. It had been warm in the sun as Horst and his big brother Otto walked home together, exchanging anecdotes about the fist fight, praising each other's fighting skills, laughing at the tragically pathetic character of Hugo Gerdler. They laughed, but the laughter rang a little hollow, as Horst remembered it now. Horst focused on that warm spring sunshine of years ago, because he was freezing now, freezing to death. Jason Darkwood was in dress blues. He remembered Maggie Barrow's wonderment when she helped him pack.
What are you going to need dress blues for?
A fleet grade officer may be called upon to...
Oh, well, excuse me, Captain, sir.
She saluted him. Maggie looked kind of funny saluting him because she was wearing one of his shirts and nothing else. They'd just made love, for the first time in a long time. In a way, Jason Darkwood wondered if that was part of what unnerved him. Had she made love to him because she thought she'd never see him again, as a parting gift? He had to find out, because if she hadn't, he wanted to convert some of his United States savings bonds into cash and help her start a civilian practice at Midwake. Married women could serve in the Navy, as doubtless Maggie would as a reserve officer, but not sea duty. He loved her. Jason straightened his tie as the fuselage door opened. He stood, along with Colonel Mann, his cap at a slightly jaunty angle, Otto Hammerschmidt, the epitome of spit and polish, and Sam Aldridge, his boots shined to mirror brightness. Jason stood beside Colonel Mann. They were of equal rank, but Darkwood stood to the left. Jason spotted the countersnipers surrounding the airfield when they taxied in. The meal, veal, vegetables, pasta, other things Jason didn't even recognize, was beyond the point of satisfying. He sat now, smoking cigars, along with Colonel Mann, Sam Aldridge, Otto Hammerschmidt, and a rather unprepossessing older fellow named Dieter Bern. The group sat in a beautifully paneled library. Paneling was a novelty to him, real paneling, because at Midwake there was no wood. Colonel Mann turned toward the knock on the door, as did Dieter Bern, the head man of New Germany. Darkwood didn't know the proper title beyond doctor. A junior grade officer, uniform creases sharp enough to cut a tough shark steak, entered the room, saluted Colonel Mann, and even bowed slightly. Colonel Mann returned the salute, took the message handed to him, and read it. Then he walked over to Otto Hammerschmidt.
Your brother, Otto, he may be gravely injured. Sergeant Schlabrendorf, whom I believe you know, Just arrived at one of our distant mountain outposts with reports of an attack by the Soviets using some type of energy weapon. An expedition is being mounted even now to reach your brother. You would care to go, of course.
Yes, Colonel.
Otto Hammerschmidt looked halfway between death and tears. Jason Darkwood's dress blues would need tending to. There was no time to hang them up. Simply change to battle gear black BDUs, grab his weapons, move to the waiting helicopter gunship, and they were off. Trees covered everything beneath them, a veritable biblical Garden of Eden. Jason understood now why the surface dwellers fought as fiercely as they did. The surface was paradise. The story of the Garden of Eden was not apocryphal, rather a prediction, not of the fall that was, but of the fall to come. The night of the war was the fall. Now, desperately, men were trying to reclaim their heritage, their future, too. Paradise was worth dying for. Paul Rubinstein sat at the main control panel of the ATSAC. Snow fell so thick, the wiper blades and defrosting system could barely keep pace. Michael came forward and stood beside him.
Want me to spell you for a while?
The ATSAC was lumbering over a ridgeline toward a plateau they had crossed before, en route to the area where Vasily Prokopyev told them he wrecked the Soviet half-track truck. The snow was deeper, of course, and the erratic winds altered the drift pattern. Because of that and the inherent ruggedness of the terrain, it was necessary to constantly monitor the heads-up display showing computer-translated readouts from the all-side sensors. Despite the comparatively enormous wheel size and base, the ATSAC could get stuck, and no group of human beings, no matter how resourceful or physically strong, could ever hope to push it out without mechanical aid.
Paul, you want me to spell...
Yeah! Soon as we get someplace where it'd be safe to change hands on the controls.
Michael leaned over Paul's shoulder.
Can you talk?
Yeah, sure. What's up?
There were a series of micro dots. Dad's got them under a microscope now. It seems to be a full set of plans for both the particle beam weapons themselves and the power source.
Great! At least we'll have what they have.
Not that great. I don't think it's intentional, probably simply because Antonovich didn't have enough scientific training to realize. I can barely read the materials, but it seems that the system for linking the power to the weapon in such a way that there is an instantaneous discharge was omitted. Without that link, the power would atomize the weapon and anything or anyone anywhere near it. We're going to need to get our hands on one of the guns themselves in order to make a working prototype from these plans, unless the scientists of New Germany or Midway are a good deal farther advanced than available data suggests.
Shit!
The ridgeline was leveling out onto the plateau, and Paul could already envision himself getting out from behind the ATSAC's controls for a while. He was starting to get a headache.
How do we get one of those guns? Oh, why did I ask that?
Well, the obvious thing that suggests itself is stealing one, right?
Logically, I suppose what we saw at that wild tribe's relocation village was a field test for one of the weapons. Before World War II, gas was tested on defenseless Ethiopians. The Spanish Civil War was in many ways a proving ground for Hitler's Condor Legion. Let me contact Captain Hartman at the base, see if there are any more reports of an energy weapon in use. We'll hurry.
As John finished speaking, Paul noticed something on the heads-up display, long-range radar data, showing incoming vehicle traffic from both the north and the east.
We got trouble, maybe!
The next instant, John dropped into the seat beside him at the secondary console.
Looks like three vehicles from the north and another three from the east, Paul.
Rourke's fingers worked over the computer console, summoning data.
Got it! The radar configurations match those of Soviet armored personnel carriers. Full-track vehicles, roughly 35 feet in length. Troop capacity 36, plus a two-man crew. All the data is tentative because they've just been introduced into the field.
Great! They're closing fast! How big are the trench, John?
Meter wide. They should be able to roll over almost anything. Michael!
Yeah?
Climb up into the gun turret and keep something in mind, Michael.
What, Dad?
If they've just been introduced into the field, these new APCs, they might have been introduced with the new armament. That'd give us six particle beam weapons to face.
Paul could feel his armpits starting to get wet with sweat. The heads-up display showed the vehicles moving into some sort of attack formation.
You got it, Paul?
As long as you want me to, John. You think we can outrun them? Or at least outmaneuver them?
Well, I have a feeling we'll find out very shortly, Paul.
Otto Hammerschmidt sat silent, staring out the window set in the helicopter's portside sliding door. The window material was bulletproof. The glass slightly distorted his view of the terrain. The dual analog-digital display Steinmetz on Darkwood's left wrist showed they'd been en route for a little bit more than an hour. These helicopter things were very fast, but Jason had to admit they almost seemed to stand still by comparison to the J-7V vertical takeoff jet fighter bombers. If Jason could get a submarine to move that fast, he smiled at the thought. But a glance at Otto Hammerschmidt, in fear for the life of his younger brother, forced the smile away. Colonel Mann strode tall and straight to the back of the gunship. His face shone open and friendly as always, yet his eyes were clouded in thought or some problem that needed resolution. He sat down beside Jason.
Captain Darkwood.
Colonel!
We will be reaching the rendezvous site in approximately 7 minutes. From the information I have been able to obtain, it would appear that some sort of energy weapon was used by the Soviet personnel who attacked the commandos of the long-range mountain patrol. Though Sergeant Schlabrendorf, Lieutenant Hammerschmidt's senior non-commissioned officer, was worn and tired, not having slept for better than 48 hours, he insisted that he be allowed to return to the aid of young Hammerschmidt. He has been brought along partially sedated. The two men are friends, you see. Rather like you and Captain Aldrich.
Colonel Mann gestured toward Sam Aldrich, asleep in the rear of the machine.
Is there much chance young Hammerschmidt survived?
Very little, but he is a good soldier, so we shall not count him among the dead yet.
He clapped Darkwood on the thigh.
I realize you are the veteran of many combats, but there could be intense fighting here. We must leave the machines and travel on foot for approximately 2 kilometers. If the KGB Elite Corps raiders who attacked the long-range mountain patrol are still in the area, there could be considerable difficulty.
Jason smiled.
I threw away the pills your friend Dr. Munchen gave me. My head aches like someone hit it with a rifle butt, but at least my head's my head again, if you know what I mean, Colonel.
Colonel Mann smiled, then started to rise.
Good man!
Michael's eyes hurt from staring, and he forced himself to blink. On the horizon, becoming visible out of a swirl of snow from the north, he saw 3 of the 6 Soviet armored personnel carriers. If his father was right, these might well be armed with the new particle beam weapons. What possible defense there could be against them was simple and obvious. Run. Running was exactly what Paul Rubinstein, still at the controls of the ATSAC, was doing now. But in case that didn't work, Michael was preparing the turret gun and his own heads-up display in the bulletproof glass dome. All 6 Soviet APCs were visible to the computer's sensing devices, and eyeballing the snow for visibility, Michael assumed that the second 3 would be visible to the naked eye in under 60 seconds. He had only test-fired the ATSAC's guns prior to leaving the German base where Vasily Prokopyev was hospitalized. Yes, the gun system worked.
I guess I'll find out how well it works soon enough.
Michael ran the computer for updated status on the guns, number of rounds, spacing of electronic tracer rounds. He noticed his palms were sweating. John sat beside Paul, watching the younger man's hands move over the ATSAC's controls. Rourke glanced up then, to the windshield and the heads-up sensor display. All 6 Soviet APCs, perhaps fitted with the new particle beam weapons, were closing, boxing them in on the plateau. Snow dispersed grudgingly before the ATSAC. The all-terrain vehicle's 3-meter-high wedge of titanium assaulted the drifts as if the snowplow and the snow were living things locked in mortal combat. But the wind blew at such velocity and the snow fell so unremittingly that despite the titanium plow's tenacity, each inch of ground taken from the wind-sculpted drifts was a major engagement. The heads-up display showed more activity now. New Soviet T-91 tanks closed from the west. The Soviet armor was huge. Put an ATSAC and one of the tanks side by side, and the ATSAC, for all its size, would be dwarfed. There were at least a dozen blips on the heads-up display identifiable as T-91s. More blips, farther away to the west, seemed to indicate a weapon system that German intelligence overflights had only recently confirmed as AV-16s, tactical missile launchers. Rourke stood up.
Paul! Stop dead! Kill all heat-emitting systems and anything that makes noise or an electronic impulse! Do it now! It's our only chance!
He was not the victim of a crash. Of that, Natalia was certain from the first. The shrapnel wound in the young officer's left shoulder clearly showed evidence that the metal fragment, about 3 inches in length and better than an inch wide, had been stabbed in like a knife would be. But his head wound was the most damning evidence. She had seen men beaten before, and he had been beaten, struck several times in the same area of the head, behind the left ear, with the proverbial blunt instrument. It was doubtful he had regained consciousness since. And of course, there were the effects of the terrific cold to consider. He suffered from frostbite, hypothermia, shock. He was in trouble, but Annie and Natalia were in worse trouble.
I've got him as bundled up as I can.
Annie knelt beside Natalia in the meager shelter of the gutted German gunship.
Then here's what we do. I'll leave you here. They'll think I'm going back to the retreat to get help to bring him in. So they'll follow me, and they'll leave some of their people to watch you. Unless they're stupid, they won't move against you, just in case they lose me. They'd want to be certain that when I bring back help, I won't suspect something is wrong. I'll lead them in the general direction of the retreat, then turn off and wait for them to catch up. You'll just have to have faith I haven't lost my touch.
Natalia smiled. Annie looked at her and pushed her hood back for a moment.
You're like Daddy. You were born with the touch.
She reached out and embraced Natalia.
If it works, I'll come back, circle around into the field out there, and try to pinpoint their location.
It's Rausch, isn't it? That man who wants to kill my mother.
Yes, I think so. From what your mother said, he must be very good, so we shouldn't underestimate him. He led your father on a merry chase and eluded him. Ordinary men don't slip through your father's fingers.
Natalia looked at the injured pilot.
Keep him as warm as you can. That's all we can do. If we can do this fast enough and well enough, maybe we'll get him back to the retreat in time to save his life.
Natalia touched at the young man's face. He was a beautiful boy, and probably younger than she thought. Then she looked out into the darkness as she pulled the scarf up over the lower portion of her face and tightened her hood. The men who beat this boy were hardly to be called men at all, and they were out there. She felt queasiness in her stomach, wondering if she still did have it, and knowing there was only one way to find out. Jason Darkwood's knowledge of horses was limited to movie and television videos with such legendary stars as John Wayne, Gary Cooper, James Stewart, Clayton Moore, Jay Silverheels, Roy Rogers, and Dale Evans. They rode proud animals, many with silver-studded saddles and names steeped in courage and romance, Silver, Scout, Trigger. When he asked if the horse he rode, neither a partly Arabian albino, nor brown and white paint, nor a golden palomino, had a name, he was told he could call the animal Fritz. No silver-studded saddle either, merely something that looked reminiscent of the McClellan saddles John Wayne and his men rode in all the John Ford cavalry movies filmed in that magically beautiful place called Monument Valley. At one time, Jason kept company with a girl who was quite the student of film and television produced in the decades prior to the night of the war. Film trivia made for interesting conversation at times. Darkwood rode with Wolfgang Mann at his right and Otto Hammerschmidt immediately behind them. They were part of a company of 40 made up of a 36-man reinforced long-range mountain commando group, the colonel, Hammerschmidt, Jason, and a doctor skilled at treating exposure, hypothermia, and the like. Their goal was approximately 10 minutes farther ahead, a high mountain plateau, a man who was probably dead and, somewhere out there marauding, a KGB Elite Corps commando unit, armed with a weapon that seemed too frightening to contemplate, but nonetheless, so frightening it could not be ignored. Natalia walked as deliberately as she could, never turning to look back, never taking her right hand from the climbing stick and shifting it to the pistol grip of her rifle as much as every fiber of her being wanted to. Her palms perspired slightly inside her gloves. She focused her mind away from the drudgery of the walk through the drifted high snow, away from the possibility that at any moment her unseen enemies would strike and preempt her own planned attack. She thought about John, but not in the way she usually thought of him, as some unattainable romantic ideal, but as a comrade, someone from whom she learned a great deal. His motto, of course, was plan ahead, and she had as best she could. Her revolvers were visible to her watching enemies over her coat, as was the rifle. But the suppressor-fitted Walther PPK S380 and the null shoulder holster beneath her parka was not. And lashed with dressmaker's elastic to the inside of her left forearm so she could get at it quickly with her right hand, but could work it free with her left if need be, was the Balisong lock knife. The retreat's main entrance access stood drifted over with so much snow there was no sign of human habitation. Rourke planned ahead there, too, because the rough road leading up to the retreat forked. Natalia took the fork, walking past safety and security. The retreat was all but impenetrable, and moved deeper along the height of the mountain. There was a niche of rock there, perfect for her purposes. If she could get that far. John and Paul dropped into chest-deep snow. The wind blew across the high plateau like a knife edge, slicing through clothing and flesh to the bone, despite any preparations against it. The Atsec was, for all intents and purposes, dead. Though ready to instantly revive, all systems now were off. Rourke was banking on a minor miracle. With the intensity of the snowfall, the constantly shifting drifts of the Atsec now stopped and disappearing into the drifts, any radar profile might be obscured enough to be missed. The only system operating aboard the Atsec was the radar countermeasures package. The computer program calculated the frequency and strength of any incoming enemy radar emission and instantly duplicated it. In effect, it absorbed the radar signal rather than bouncing it back to its origin, then broadcast an identical signal so there would not be even a radar shadow. In theory, at least, the system worked like that. But whether the combination of falling snow, drifting snow, and counter-radar measures would work to so completely obscure the ATSAC that the enemy combat vehicles would pass the ATSAC by was another question. Rourke's M16 would be useless to him against the vehicles themselves, but if his plan worked, he'd be close enough to their occupants for the assault rifle to be effective, and to gain the secret to the Soviet particle beam technology. Nikolai Antonovich considered another sexual encounter with the beautiful Svetlana Alexeva, her blonde hair loose to her shoulders and her blue eyes just a little glassy as she sipped at her vodka. They were alone in the hermetically sealed environment tent, but even while they were off-duty, other members of the joint military and scientific team continued the attempt to make contact. The helicopters that towed the enormous floating platform constructed for just this purpose floated idly on the surface of the ocean, a minimum distance of 50 meters from the sides of the platform. They waited at the ready to bring the platform to its next location or to evacuate the occupants of the platform if needed. Despite the platform's size, it shifted as the surface of the sea shifted. Antonovich overcame the feeling of nausea this caused early on, as had Svetlana, but other members of the party did not fare as well. They rode the ocean as 1 hour changed into the next, one day into another, and no answer from their possible comrades beneath the sea. Svetlana, although she was using him, was very beautiful, and although he doubted the depths of her passion, she was satisfying to him nonetheless.
"We have made contact! A submarine! The Red Star!"
Antonovich stood and straightened his uniform. So much for passion. Natalia kept her same steady pace as she crossed around the tight bend in the right fork of the road, some several hundred meters beyond the entrance to the retreat. As she passed the bend, she veered left, swinging her Colt assault rifle forward and, along with the climbing stick, using its capped muzzle as a probe within the drifts to find her footing, and she pushed herself up from the trail. If they were far enough behind her and the wind kept steady, her footprints would obliterate quickly. She moved through the rocks now as quickly as she carefully could. She angled toward a niche in the rocks and dropped from sight of the path. She rolled onto her back and looked up into the swirling snow. Within seconds, the snow covered her goggles. Natalia smiled and removed the M16's muzzle cap, but kept the dust cover closed against the snow. Annie touched her fingers to the young man's throat beneath the blanket swathed around him. His pulse was very weak. She made a decision. Quickly opening her parka, then parting his blankets, she slid beneath them and held the dying man's head to her chest. She drew his body close to hers, put her own parka partially around him, then pulled up the blankets to cover them both. Annie drew the young man closer to her, her M16 beside her, her eyes on the night. Eight men in a classic Vietnam-era American Special Forces patrolling formation moved through the snow below her, their weapons at the ready, each guarding the other's back. The muzzles of their weapons rose and fell as they turned, never crossing the body planes of their fellows. It was like a ballet, nearly that graceful, and like ballet, it told a story. These men were very good and very experienced, working with each other, a troop, as it were. They knew each other so well that their cues were so subtle that no observer would ever notice them. Nazis, she presumed. As a Russian, she was raised to have no fondness for them, thought Stalin a madman in the privacy of her own mind, forever having allied with them only to reap the wrath of their betrayal. History aside, these Nazis she watched were no bitter memory spoken of by survivors of a previous generation. They were flesh and blood and death. Eight of them, one of her. She would have to lower those odds.